You know, we've been talking this week about the subject of addiction, and we've defined it thus far as obsessive compulsive behaviors. And when we find when we have someone in our family that brings introduces addiction to our family, it changes the entire family. That's something that's hard to accept for many people. Because in the addictive family, what often we do is designate this person who is the addict is the problem and the rest of us are okay. But can we be involved in trauma and not be impacted by it? Can we be surrounded by chaos and it not influence us? Could a person go and live in a war zone and not have the memories and the residual effects of that war zone? And I think to ask that is to take us where we want to go. The answer is no. So all of these things do affect us. Tonight I want to talk about the addicted family. And to begin with, I think that we really need to do a brief rehearsal of the home as God would have it. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail in this, although there's enough in the first two pages of this PowerPoint to have a whole lesson. But it is necessary for us to be on the same page as to what a functional home is before we talk about what a dysfunctional home is. So I want to just kind of go through a few brief things on this. When we talk about an addicted family, we're talking about whether the addiction is to alcohol or whether it's to substances, controlled or prescription, or if it's something that's over-the-counter that's being abused. We're talking about all that whole realm. People who are dependent on or have become dependent upon the use of a chemical. So in usual families, I suggest first is that every family has something to work on. I have yet to meet the family or to see the family that doesn't have something that is a problem. We're all families are dysfunctional in some ways. There are no perfect families. But all of us have room to grow. I believe that by nature, people are selfish. That is, that we look for what does it take for me to survive in a particular setting. When it comes to families, sometimes families, the individuals in families, can act very selfishly rather than acting together as a unit. So the concept here is that when we are in a family, we need to work on team building, on working together, sharing our mutual issues, enjoying our joys together, and sharing our sorrows, among other things. Families need to be cohesive rather than running in parallels. We need to work together as a family, each building off of the other. One of the assignments I give in family sessions is I ask the question to families, why are you married? And I get some kind of odd answer sometimes. Sometimes I don't get an answer at all. I just get a straight look. Why'd y'all get married? Because people will bring their problems to me. It's like, well, first let's find out why you got married. And I'll hear things like, well, we dated a long time, and it was either break up or get married, so we decided to get married. That's not a good reason to get married. Somebody says, oh, we fell in love. Well, love isn't something you fall in, like when you walk through a cow pasture. Love is something you grow in. People give all kinds of things, but usually I don't get a real well-thought-out answer on that as to why you're married. So I ask it a different way. What are you all trying to accomplish in your family? And I don't usually get a cohesive statement on that when we ask the husband and the wife and maybe the kids, what are you all trying to accomplish in your family? And what I find is a lot of families have no plan. So the assignment that I generally give them, and I'll give to you if you'll accept it tonight, is to draw up a mission statement for your family. There is no business that can exist without a clear mission statement to give it direction. In the same way, if we view the home as an organization, God's first organization, then we need to figure out what is the mission of this home. What are we trying to accomplish here? You know, are we just a hotel to drop in once in a while? Or are we trying to drive toward a goal? And a mission statement may look something like this, and I'll make this one up actually. But it may look like we are here as a family to provide a spiritual setting wherein each can thrive and please God. We are here to extend hospitality to guests in our home. And you get the idea of where you go with that. Mission statement doesn't have to be long, but it needs to be concise and it needs to be very, very understandable for the whole family. So then the question becomes, once we know what our mission is, then what are the activities that fit within that mission and what activities are going to take away from our mission? If we're going to use drugs or alcohol in the home, that will very likely take away from what we're trying to accomplish. But before we can even start, we need to know, what are you trying to do in this family? Why are you married? Why do you exist as a family? And it should be a reason that we can build on and draw our activities from and plan our life around. Well, when we look at the home as God would have it, and this is, God describes a functional home. He is the designer of this first institution. Church is the second, but this is the first. And in this, God designed one man for one woman for a lifetime. And the passages here, you can look at those. Genesis, God performed the first marriage ceremony. And Jesus goes back to the beginning when there's a question asked about breakups in marriages. And Jesus says, from the beginning, it's not been so. He goes back to the Garden of Eden, how God originally had established the home. So it's basically one man for one woman for life. In the days of pop bottles, we had no deposit and no return bottles. And that's exactly what a marriage is. Is something that when you marry, that you marry for a lifetime. That doesn't mean one of you kills the other so you can get out of your marriage. But you marry for a lifetime. In terms of the roles in a marriage, the wife is assigned some very specific roles, and we can just look at these briefly. She is to receive honor from her husband. And the concept of honor here is respect and love. And that should be something the wife receives out of the marriage. She is to be properly adorned in modest apparel and with shamefastness and sobriety, Peter tells us. So that the woman has a certain conduct or attitude that is to be displayed in the home. She is referred to as the weaker vessel, and that doesn't mean that she's lesser than. Actually, what it means is that she is more important than, because she is to be honored or basically placed on a pedestal in the home. The home centers around mom. She is the weaker vessel in that she is more fragile. God designed women that way because their task primarily is going to be to carry a child during the incubation period and to deliver and to maintain that child through those growing up years. And regardless of what the modern culture says, this is what God says on it. And the husband is to honor her in that and not mistreat her in that role. She is also supposed to be a keeper at home. Now that does not say keep her at home. It says she's a keeper at home. In other words, her primary responsibility is to provide that cohesion, the daily functions of the family. That's the primary responsibility. But it doesn't preclude working outside the home. We have examples of that, such as the virtuous woman over in Proverbs. But she looks well to the ways of her house. She is a keeper at home. She takes honor, or she takes some pride in how her home is maintained, how the children are scheduled in that home. She takes some pride in that. And obviously, passages talk about the woman is to be in subjection. Sometimes men will take this passage and misuse it. That is, they'll use this to beat the wife over the head with and tell her, well, you're not in subjection. And I want you to just look at this. It tells the wife she is to be in subjection. But notice that command is not to the husband. It's to the wife. That subjection is a voluntary subjection on the part of the wife. It does not say the husband is to force that on the wife. As a matter of fact, if you look a few verses earlier, there in Ephesians 5, you will find that it says all of us are to be in subjection one to the other, the same word. So the wife is not the only one that needs to be in subjection. In a very general way, husbands and wives and other Christians are in subjection one to another. But in the family life, the husband and the wife have a subjection role, in other words, a subordinate role of kind of the chain of command or the chain of authority. So the husband, on the other hand, is charged with being the primary provider. If any doesn't provide for his own, and especially those of his own household, he's denied the faith and is worse than a heathen. Now notice there's two levels of provision there. One is providing for your own. That's those people that are, I would take that to be your blood kin or those that depend upon you. Those are the folks that you provide for. But then he narrows it down more, and he says, and especially those of your own household. So those that live in your house, you especially provide for them. So the role of provider has a larger circle, but it also has a smaller one. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. Husband is to love his wife like Christ loved the church. Christ never has done anything that would make the church think that we were second on his list or that we didn't matter. Instead, his focus is on loving the church as it needs to be loved. In 1 Corinthians 7, not on here, you may want to write it down, and verse, I believe it's 33, Paul talks about the married life and married responsibilities in the church in Corinth, but he also goes down in verse 33, and he says, talk about single and married, and he says the single man focuses on the things of God, that is, has a more focused approach, but the married man focuses on how he may please his wife. Now, I've just kind of got hung up on that verse lately because I see a lot of men that don't focus on that, on how they can please their wife. Instead, they're out here trying to please themselves or going on tra-la about their life. But the husband, as God would have him, not only loves his wife, but he is looking for, how do I please this lady in my life? How do I help her feel special? Now, people talk a lot of times in marriage about problems they have with intimacy. But what they fail to realize is intimacy is not a sexual word. It is a bonding word that has to do with how we treat each other throughout the entire day. And it's not just, it's not primarily a sexual term. We'll look at that Friday night. But the husband is to be the spiritual leader of the family. And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but nurture them in the chastening and admonition of the Lord. So the father's role, as defined here, is to provide spiritual leadership, spiritual direction in the ways of the Lord, and to provide that to his family. What does that mean? In the home that is functional as God has designed it, there are studies, home studies, there's prayer, those kinds of things that take place. And who leads that? The husband is the one that has the primary charge. It doesn't mean the woman can't. Timothy's mother and grandmother certainly taught him, and so another example of that. But the primary responsibility, as God designed it, is to the husband. And then again, he is to nourish and cherish his wife. He's to feed the relationship and to hold it as that which is precious. So just calling your wife precious is not what he's talking about here. He's talking about treating someone where they feel precious, like a special, special gem in their life. Not a J-I-M, a G-E-M. Okay? All right. They're both to be sexually available to one another, husband and wife, not to defraud one another. I'm going to save that for Friday night. We're going to talk about all that. But the children in the home, first, the children have some obligations in the functional home, as God would have it, and their obligation is to be obedient to their parents. As a matter of fact, in Romans 1, that's the list of the roll call of the damned, is children who were disobedient to parents. And for those sake, God gave them up, among the other things listed there. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. Why? Did your kids ever ask you that? Why do I need to do that? You know, my kids always got mad, upset with me when I said, well, you know, I guess the answer to that is this is right. And that's the only answer you need. God said this is the order. It's not about parents obey your children, but it's about children obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. We need to avoid favoritism, as in the case with Jacob and Esau, and we see a fiasco that is even today playing out because of favoritism played in a family long ago. We're to train them in the ways of the Lord. Children are to be trained in the ways of the Lord. And that means they're going to need to spend some time with their Bible, with their parents, with those that would instruct them, and they need to focus on spiritual things. You need to know your Bible, young people. As you grow and develop, that will be the foundation that you will need in life. And as you get older, you also will need to continue that. But training up in the ways of the Lord is essential. If you don't get that from your parents, then you find some adults that can help you to understand this. In the book of Proverbs, we have a father who says, my son, in that book a lot of times. And what he's doing is he's giving instruction, coaching, counseling to his son. Those are talks that moms and dads, but especially in that book, that dads need to have with their children about the foundations of wisdom, about not running with gangs, about not getting caught up in the wrong crowd, about not going out after folks that are looking for promiscuity. All that's in there. Those are conversations that need to take place in the home as God would have it. Those can't take place if we are distracted by, overly distracted by those conveniences that rob us of that social or that interaction with one another. This has to be here. And then children are to honor their father and their mother. Honor your father and mother means to respect. It means respect mingled with love. And what it says is that's the first commandment with promise. What's the promise? That you may live long upon the earth. What does that mean? That means if you go into a crazy lifestyle, you're going to have a short life. If you have obedience to your parents, then you're much more likely to have a prolonged life. In terms of parenting, parents are to set proper examples for their kids, to nurture and care for them, and create an environment in which they can thrive. Discipline is something that is to be done in the home, but as James Dobson said a long time ago, discipline is not something you do to the child, it's something you do for the child. Discipline is from a word mean to disciple, and that means to train up in a particular mindset, a particular way. So the disciples of Christ were people that were trained up on, and they were schooled in how to follow Christ. What does Christ want you to do? Discipline in the home is something we do to curb the child where they fall in line with whatever the family rules are, hopefully in harmony with God's Word. We don't discipline our children out of anger. They are not people to beat up or to take our frustrations out on. But instead, discipline is something that is intended to correct the child's behavior, not to brutalize the child. Okay? Not all kids are the same. In Ephesians, the 6th chapter, there we find, and you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. There are some children, if you push them too far, you're going to make them mad and they're going to buck on you. They're going to fight you back. And what we're told is, don't provoke your children to the point that you drive them to wrath or to rage. But there's another passage that looks like it's parallel, but it's not. The context is the same, talking about families, but in Colossians 3:21, it says, and you fathers, provoke not your children, lest they be discouraged. Now there's a difference in being discouraged and being angry. And what he's talking here is about a different kind of child. Here's a child, if you over-discipline this child, you break their spirit. And what he's saying in Colossians is, don't break your child's spirit, lest they be discouraged. And in Ephesians, he's saying, don't drive them to become rebel children. Whole lessons on that, and we are not here to talk particularly about all that. But over time, what we have is a role reversal. Whereas, when we are young, mom and dad take care of us when we can't take care of ourselves. They guide us along through life. But then at some point, the roles reverse, and mom and dad, if they're still alive, are not able to care for themselves as perhaps they need to. They need a little help. And so, the role reverses, and the children then take care of the parents. In Matthew 15, that's even financial, that where we find some there were taking what needed to go to the parents to help them, and they were throwing it in the treasure down at the temple, and they were told they dishonored their parents because they really weren't taking care of their parents. So as our parents get older, we have an obligation to take care of them or to care for our parents. And that was written long before the days of social welfare and the various governmental systems that kind of have taken some of that responsibility off of the home and off of the children. And I'm not against those. But we need to use the resources available to us. But if those agencies exist or if they don't exist, the Bible still exists. And there's still obligations that we have here that we need to meet. Well, when God's order is disrupted, that's the functional home. So let's talk now about a dysfunctional home. So this is a home where God's order is disrupted by introduction of drunkenness or substance abuse or some other addiction that creates insane patterns in the family. The family goes out of balance. It's not in balance with what God wants it to be. Now, Ernie Larson's in his studies on the home or in his presentations has a mobile. And in that mobile, there's five or six family members kind of in one of these, you know, wind chime kind of thing. And what he will do is he will take one of those off and say, this is the attic. And when he does, that whole wind chime gets out of balance. And it teeters for a while. And then finally it finds a new balance. And then what he will do is he will take that attic piece of the wind chime, and he will hang it back on the mobile. And what we find is when you put that other roll back in, it begins to teeter again till it finds a balance. And I guess what that illustrates to me is that when someone is not fulfilling their role in the family, then the family gets out of balance, but the family adjusts to the out of balance. And the out of balance can become normal. For instance, in the alcoholic family, here's a young lady I talked with that said, you know, I want to have some of my friends over. So she invites her friends over, and Dad's laying out on the front stoop by one of the bushes. And he's laying out there, and she steps over and walks on in the house, and her friends look at her. It's like, was your dad okay? Aren't you going to help him? Oh, he's just drunk. For her, that was normal. But for her friends, it was like, well, do we need to call 911? Because they realize in their setting, that wasn't normal. But in the addicted home, we get used to things that are abnormal being normal. We get used to the chaos and the fuss and the games that get played in the addicted family, the manipulation that happens. We get used to that, and that's just how our family is. And so we accept that, or we may grudgingly accept it. But when we have an addict or an alcoholic in the family, then the family is going to be out of balance. And as that addict or alcoholic gets better, what we may find is the family still out of balance because someone else in the family may actually be sicker than the alcoholic or the addict. In other words, there may be some real dysfunction. The healthier the sick one gets, the more the others have a problem. Let me illustrate that. We had a little kid named Josh who was brought in to an inpatient psychiatric unit on our children's unit. And he was brought in because of his behaviors and because he was having seizures. Okay, so our psychiatrist and the neurology department worked with this little kid. and they got him to where he wasn't having any seizures. They got all those under control. And so we were kind of proud of the work we did, so we worked with his family just a little bit, and then we sent him home. And 3 weeks later, he came back, and he was having seizures. Or at least that was what was reported. And we couldn't figure what was going on. His medications were adjusted. His body systems were back in line. You know, what's going on with this kid? And then we dug down a little deeper, and what we found out is while little Johnny was having his seizures, supposedly, something else was happening in the house. And that is, Mom and Dad were going at it, and Dad was beating on Mom. And when that happened, when Dad started beating on Mom, guess what little Johnny did? He had a seizure. Those were pseudo-seizures. And what happened is, as we healed him, or as we helped him to get past the actual seizures, they served a purpose in that family. And without the sick one being sick, the family was having trouble functioning. So he faked it. That was an alcoholic family, but a little different scenario. But such is the case as we take an addict or an alcoholic and we try to help them to get better, and then we put them back in a setting where they were broken, and the family may need them to be sick in order for the family to function. Now that's a sad thing to say, but the family may not know how to function without somebody being sick in the family, or without a whole lot of that. Okay, let's look at some definitions. Okay. The alcoholic or addict can become becomes dependent on their chemical, but the family can become addicted to the addict. In other words, we become obsessed. As they become obsessed with the chemical, we can become obsessed with the addict, with the one that's got the problem. In other words, our mind, our time is spent. What are we going to do about the one with the problem? What are we going to do with our addict? And so we spend time like, well, we're going to need to search the room, be sure that they haven't hid something in there. We don't want to have a drug bust in our house and have our house confiscated. Well, what about our car? We need to check that out too. So Friday night, we spend searching a room, or we spend out here trying to play catch me if you can with the addict. We may want to follow them down the street and be sure they're going the right place. In other words, we become obsessed with what that person's doing. And in doing that, we don't do the stuff we need to do. We neglect our own responsibilities. And that takes us down the path where our behavior can kind of become a little insane. Normal families don't search their kids' room on Friday nights. Normal families don't go looking for pipes and syringes and those kinds of things. That's not what normal families do. Functional families do something a little different. But in the addicted family, that may be a way of life. The term codependency is one that's been thrown around a lot, and that's the concept that the addict's dependent on the chemical, and we are addicted to the addict. And thus, codependency. Both are dependent on something else. When that happens, then we are having problems in this family life and the function of the family. One in four children who live in a home, one in four children live in a home where alcohol is used or abused daily. That's 25% of young people. Now, if you're in public schools or your children play out here in public arena, that's the folks that are out there. Actually, it's interesting that one in four people that are driving down the road have a blood alcohol level that is above the level for intoxication. They shouldn't be behind the wheel. That's 25% of the people on the road. Be careful, because you're passing folks that are inebriated. But that takes place in families. But that inebriation may mean that Daddy or Mama throws the kids in the car and drives down the road either drunk or high on drugs. And they're riding down the road and endangering their children. And that can be a source of a lot of fuss and fight in a family and a lot of disequilibrium. All right. But children of alcoholics and addicts are at greater risk for mental illness, depression, anxiety, we're going to talk about those two the next two nights, mood disorders, health problems, learning difficulties, and also for them to turn to substance abuse as a lifestyle. So the equilibrium of the family, the balance in the family, is thrown off by the addiction. It begins to define the family. And so the family learns how to live out of balance, out of equilibrium. And when recovery comes, the family finds itself having to shift again. So here's the situation. The addicted one, or the alcoholic, is often the focus of the family. What are we going to do with this one? Now, when we focus on this one, who is the addict or alcoholic, what we do often is we lose focus on the others. So here's what happens. We are focused on, we got to get you well, we got to bail you out of jail, we got to watch you all the time, we got to be sure you're not doing... We're focused over here on this one, and it's kind of like playing whack-a-mole. You all ever see whack-a-mole? Okay. Whack-a-mole, where you get this thing pop up, and you know, you whop it down, and something else pops up, and you're just out here always just kind of bouncing. Well, you all know what whack-a-mole is, don't you? Yes. They do have that in Arkansas. Okay. They have it in Indiana. Okay, thank you. All right. But, that's how it feels to the parent or to the people who are trying to be healthy in the family, is we just can't keep all this thing in the right sequence. And so the one who's identified as being sick gets the attention. But in the meantime, these others aren't getting attention. And what happens when a child's left to himself? Does he bring shame to his mother? The proverb writer says that he or she does. And so we have children who are being neglected. Their needs aren't being met because we're taking our energy and putting it over here on this addicted person. What happens to the marriage? If this is a husband, then what we may have is the mother then shifts, and her job is to protect and try to save these kids, and especially if there's domestic violence going on or verbal abuse, and that very likely is happening, or physical abuse. And so we want to protect the kids. That becomes the role, say, of the mom or of the dad if the mom is the one that has the problem, the identified problem. So the whole family gets out of balance. Now, when these families come to a church near you, this one, or wherever you worship, and they come in, they may come in with a smile on their face, and we may say, "How are you doing?" And they may say, "Fine." I think sometime the church building is the palace of perjury. We need to be honest with each other. If I'm not having a fine, the answer is not always fine. Sometimes I have rotten days. Do y'all? Do you say that, or you say, "Oh, I'm fine"? We'll put on our plastic smiles and say, "I'm fine." Anyway, that's another story. But we can do that, and all the while we are dying inside. We're hurting inside, but we are so ashamed that these things are taking place in our family. We feel so guilty that maybe I'm not a good family member, a good parent, a good child. Maybe mom and dad have this problem because I blame it on myself. So the guilt travels through the family, and it's kind of shared. The addict feels guilty for using. Often the guilt and shame rest there. But then the guilt and shame rest with, well, I'm married to a drunk, or I'm married to a drug addict. And so the guilt and shame, feeling lesser than, that resides over there. And then the children feel like they have contributed. It's our fault they're this way. It's my fault that daddy hit mommy because I said something I shouldn't, or they were arguing about me and this thing got out of control. So guilt just kind of permeates this family. But the addicted family is a family of secrets. In other words, it's a closed family system, usually. And the reason is, you better not tell people what goes on behind closed doors. So here's the unspoken rules in the addicted family. The unspoken rules or don't feel, don't tell, and don't trust. So trust begins to run away, to be on the back burner with this family. We can't trust anybody to tell them what's going on, because when you do, the lid blows off. So don't tell anybody what's happening here. Don't trust anybody with our family secret, and by all means, don't feel. So the result of that is that this child or this person in the family often can feel like they're growing up in a fog, challenging and questioning whether maybe they are mentally ill, maybe they're crazy, and nobody's telling them. And so their approach to the world as they leave and go out in the world is like, you know, something's wrong with me. You know, and that's why they're acting that way, because, and so we personalize that. Well, all right. So this insane pattern surrounds the addict and the alcoholic. Now, the addict is going to try to protect their addiction. So where do I have my supply? And I'm going to keep my stash, if you would. In other words, I'm going to have some for later or for if I need it. If I'm out here tweaking and I need to finish off a run, then I'm going to have something here to do that with. And you can usually find a stash where you find a using addict or alcoholic. You'll find that they have stored some up for a little later. The question becomes, well, where is he? Where did they go? Are you sure they went there? When are they going to be back? 9,000 questions. That becomes the topic of the family discussion instead of the normal things in a functional family. We're preoccupied when they're home, what are they doing? And when they're away, where'd they go? And so they become the center of attention. You get the idea here. All right. And then the feelings of unworthiness, guilt, and shame. And ultimately, the family begins to withdraw from their families and their friends out there and from family members. Because we don't know, with this unpredictable person in our family, we don't know when that person's going to make a fool out of themselves. But if we connect with our family and friends, we get the question, well, where is Joe? Or where is whoever it is that's the addict? Where are they? And now you got to answer. So where are they? When you answer, are you going to tell the truth? Well, they're on a binge, and are they're on a roll. You know, they're shot an eight ball and hadn't come home yet. What are you going to tell them? Are you going to tell them the truth? Probably not. Most folks don't. They cover for them. And so now we put the family in a situation where they may lie or deceive or withdraw from other people because they don't want to have to deal with explaining that which is an embarrassment to the family. Okay? Now, the more they withdraw, the more then, the harder it is to provide help to them because they're isolating themselves out here. You starting to get the picture of what this is? Anybody know what I'm talking about? Okay, this is bad stuff, isn't it? All right, so the guilt and the shame's out there. Children, on the other hand, a lot of times we'll find that in the addicted family that family members will avoid home. That is, I would rather stay after school and participate in everything I can participate in to delay the inevitable that I go home, and when I go home, it's like walking on eggshells. Home is really unsafe and unpredictable. When I walk in that door, I don't know if I'm going to get slammed and knocked across the room. I don't know if I'm going to be hugged and everything's all right. I don't know what's going to go on in that home. So what do? We start avoiding home. We may find that either the husband or wife starts working over, even when they don't have to. I remember the Christmas Eve, I was at a hospital working there, and actually I was assigned that particular evening on Christmas Eve. And along came one of the managers down the hall and spoke to me. Well, it was 8 o'clock on Christmas Eve. And I asked her, it's like, well, why are you here? And she asked me, well, I'm going to ask you the same question. Well, I was there because I was on the schedule. But when I asked her, why are you here? She kind of laughed. She says, you know, Art, I really don't want to go home. What a sad statement. Here's a time that families get together and you don't want to go home. Now, I knew what was going on because I knew her family. I knew her husband had started drinking because this is a holiday. And after all, that's one of the acceptable times to just get plastered. And she didn't want to have to face that. So she used that opportunity to catch up on work. She made work for herself, actually. But such is what happens. You see some other things in here that happen in the addicted family. The financial uncertainty, many of these families just kind of go down the tubes financially, especially if there are fines and legal fees and all that that really get in the way of the financial thing. Lack of sleep. Someone stays up to 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning wondering when they're going to get home, when the other person is going to get home. Fear that the marriage will break up. And if the marriage breaks up, then what's that going to be like for our family? How are we going to survive? And so a lot of worry, anxiety, frustration goes on in these homes. And often there is self-neglect. In other words, we're so focused out here that we really don't take care of ourselves. All right. Now, in the addicted family, there is generally going to be periods of sobriety. Periods of time that the person is not using. And everything may look like it's great. And those are the times that give us hope. But we may also have times where the person acts like they have the behaviors they have when they're using, but they aren't using. And we call those dry drunks. And then there's always the slippery slopes where people are really struggling, kind of planning their next use. That happens in the room. But during all of this, there's an elephant in the room. Oh, it's not a pink elephant. It's not a white elephant. But there is an unspoken, huge obstacle in the family. And it's something no one talks about. And it's called the addiction. Why don't we talk about it? Because when we bring that subject up, there is going to be chaos and a fuss, and people are going to be at each other, and nothing good is going to happen when we bring that subject up. So we don't talk about it. Instead, we try to avoid it. So when we avoid it, we develop maladaptive roles. I'm not going to talk about the real problem, about the thing that we really need to resolve, because I don't want a fuss going on. So one person takes on the role of an enabler. An enabler is someone who basically is going to soften the blow. They're going to tell you, it's not all that bad, it could be a lot worse. The enabler is going to be someone who will, if you get a call that this person's in jail, oh, we got to go get them out. And so in the middle of the night, we got to raise $500, $1,000 for bail and run down there because, after all, we don't want our loved one in jail. And so we're out here trying to rescue, to save, to soften the blow on that individual. Here's what I would suggest, and we're not going to have time to talk a lot about enablers and codependents, but what I would suggest is that if we soften the blow, if we soften the consequence of their addiction, they will probably stay in their addiction. Why? Because the pain of the addiction is not there. Why not? Because we took it away. So what's left? The pleasure of the addiction. And as long as they're having fun in their addiction and we're covering the back door, why would you quit? See that? So one of the hardest things to do, the enabler wants to make it all go away. I want to fix it best I can. But one of the hardest things to do is to step back and practice what's called tough love. And what that is you got yourself in this. There's some consequences, and you need to get yourself out of it. One of our a fellow that has an alcoholic son, his son called him and said, Dad, I need you to come get me out of jail. They picked me up. You know, I stole the license plate off the company vehicle and put it on my vehicle. Well, I was drunk and I was riding down the road and I got arrested. And you know what his daddy told him? See you when you get out. Now, his daddy is one of those guys that brings the paycheck home and throws it on the table, and the company had to call and say, "Ralph, would you cash some of those checks? You're messing up our bookkeeping." Now, I don't have to be asked to cash my check. But he had to be. So he had the money. He had the means to do it. Maybe that had something to do with his son having stole his mandolin. By the way, Ralph collects vintage instruments. And his son had stolen those things and had pawned those to get his drugs and his alcohol. Dad says, "See you when you get out." Now, he tried to call very frequently, "Dad, don't you love me anymore? Do you love my brother more than you love me?" He did every manipulation in the book. And you know what Ralph said? "See you when you get out." You know what? This old boy got out, and guess what? He told his dad, he said, "You know what? You're serious." Well, Ralph knew he was serious. And he said, "You're not going to help me if I do that, are you?" Ralph said, "Nope." He hadn't been back in yet. I hope there's not a yet to it. But until you can feel, until the pain of the addiction becomes greater than the pleasure of the addiction, the person will stay in their addiction. Now, in the family, when we have the addictive family, there are going to be some other roles that will be played. And sometimes people may take on more than one role. But a role can be the lost child. This is the young person that has figured out, when everything's rocking and rolling, I better stay out of the way. So this person is one, you don't hardly even know they're there. They may be off with their nose in a book, or they may run to their room as soon as the chaos breaks out in the family. This lost child, and they're not going to be a lot of trouble in the family, because they're going to hide out in that house. No safe place to go, so I will make a place where I can virtually disappear here at home. That's the lost child. Superhero says, "You know, our family has really made us ashamed, so I'm going to have to do something to make my family proud." And this is the person that may excel in athletics or may excel in some particular event at school. They may be a valedictorian of a class. They may be out here in some sports activity as kind of a champion. But that superhero is out here in this role. I've got to make the family proud of us. Well, then there's the mascot. And the mascot's usually the youngest one. And that mascot is like the little puppy dog. Everybody, they're just cute. Okay? And everybody wants to take care of the little mascot. Okay? And then there's the rebel child. The rebel child says, "Oh, you want problems? Well, let me show you problems." This is James Dean, for those that remember that. Okay. This is the one that says, "Okay, I don't need to follow the rules. This, living in this family is crazy. So I'll just do what I want to do." And so they kick up their heels, they get themselves in trouble, and that's the rebel child. All right. Now, in the addicted family, those roles are going to be played out. And you can almost identify which is which. And in the addicted family, a lot of times in exercise, I'll ask them, "Would you identify which role or roles that you're playing?" A lot more than those, but those are the basic ones. Okay. Did you know you can love someone to death? Literally. I love this addict, and I am going to do whatever I'm calling love, even if it kills them. Sometimes love goes too far, or what we call love. Do you know there's just a fine line between pity and love? We feel sorry for them. Oh, they're trying so hard. Oh, I know what kind of person they can be. And so we actually end up loving that person, and the love we're giving them doesn't help them. It hurts them, because we're doing too much for them. We can put a family member above our relationship to God. Many's the time that I've seen, and perhaps you have too, that a family member is walking disorderly, and the church is trying to do something to address that issue. And here comes the family to rescue the person, you know, that they perceive as being beat up by the brethren. Instead, the church is here to help and support us, and certain behaviors aren't going to be followed. But if we aren't going to be tolerated. But if we're out here trying to protect this addict or alcoholic, then we may find ourselves in a fight even with the church. We can become partakers in their sins. And the way we do that is by lying for them, cheating, call in when we get a call. Someone says, "Can I speak to so-and-so?" And they're laying over there all passed out. It's like, "Well, they're not here right now." "Yeah, they are. Yeah, they are. They're laying out in the recliner." Okay, and we can block attempts to help them. This one, paying their dealer. Sometimes family members do insane things. There was a lady, her son was using heroin, and she got a call from the son's dealer. The dealer says, "Hey, you bring me X number of dollars, your son owes that to me for stuff he's bought from me, and you bring that to me on such and such corner by 5 o'clock or I'm going to kill your son." What would you do? You know what she did? She got the stuff and went down and paid off the dealer. And guess what? The son went back and bought some more. Because he was running a tab. Mom thought she was saving her son's life. But guess, just think about that. I asked the group about it. I said, "What do you think?" And they laughed. Some of them were dealers. They laughed. They said, "Why would I kill the person who's buying from me? I would be killing my customer." They laughed. But he was playing his mom. So I asked his mom in the group, I said, "How do you look in orange?" Now, some of y'all have orange on tonight, and I know you didn't come from prison. But up in Indiana, orange and burgundy are the prison colors. And I asked her, "How do you look in that?" Because what you actually did is you closed a drug deal. You became a part of that deal. And we had some legal people in the group, and I asked them, "Am I right or wrong on that?" And they said, "You're right." And if we wanted to prosecute, that could be prosecuted, that you became a part of their deal and could do some jail time for that. Well, all right. Sometimes we make alibis or we excuse their actions or we try to clean up their messes. They get in all kinds of things. All right. So what we need to do as family members is look at what part am I playing in this issue. And if I'm playing a part in it, then what I need to do is to back off. Am I a part of the solution or am I a part of the problem? And sometimes we may not be able to see that ourselves, so we need to run it by somebody else that's thinking better than we are. Because our best thinking's got us in this mess we're in. And it's got the family in the mess they're in. So we need someone who can think more clearly, more objective, and that would be in a place like this, it would be those who that you would go to here for help. Maybe a class teacher, maybe elder, deacon, maybe Elijah or someone else. But who your go-to people that can help you think when you're not thinking straight. And you need to run this by them. But in the meantime, when we got all this craziness going on in our home, then we can easily have other sins going on that are my sins. Things I need to repent of as the codependent in the home. Such things as deception. I'm trying to hide what they're doing. I'm not quite shooting square with people. Or I'm so bitter and hateful about what's going on, I'm mad. And I may be taking that out on people. Well, I think the Bible says, "Let all bitterness and wrath and malice be put away from." Does your Bible say that? Mine does. These verses tell us that. We may end up hating someone. I can't stand the sight of him anymore. You know, I wish they'd die and get out of their misery so the rest of us can get on with our life. Rage, malice, bitterness, evil speaking about one another. Those are all sins. And we've got to be careful that in the midst of dealing with the addict, that we don't get into the midst of wrong attitudes toward that addict or toward that situation. And I want to tell you what, that's hard to do. So not only does the addict alcoholic have something to do, but those that are surrounded by that person, they also have something to do. The battle that we are fighting is not with our addict or alcoholic. The battle we are fighting is a spiritual battle. It's a battle against Satan. And we need to remember who the enemy is. The enemy is not our family member. The enemy is the devil who's trying to take our family member from us. We're not giving that family member up. We're not giving that church member up. When this person is under the full attack of Satan, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but our battle is a spiritual battle in the heavenly places. Okay, one of the things I want to suggest first in our homes is safety first. And what that means is we've got to keep our addict or alcoholic alive. If they're not alive, they can't get better. So what we want to do, safety first, we want to do what it takes to keep them alive. Keep them out of harm's way. So they don't get all caught up in stuff. Okay. But at the same time, we don't want to take away the logical and natural consequences of their action. And we need to find people that we can trust. Realize the addict, alcoholic, is having their own set of issues. Now let me... And I know our time has passed, so I'm just going to go over this relatively quickly. If you have a notepad, you may want to write this down. This is not on the PowerPoints. But the question becomes at this point, what are we supposed to do? And I want to suggest that the church can help out by providing educational classes to its members. Classes on things like boundaries, proper boundaries, setting boundaries, communication, parenting, single parenting, finances, and perhaps some things on addiction. Those would all be some classes that a church could do. The church could provide support circles. And what a support circle would probably look like, it'd be similar to a support group. It'd be the people who identify they want to help folks work on these problems. Maybe they've got the problem themselves. But we're going to get together as a group and we're going to work on these issues. What I have found, and actually started a new model that will come out somewhere in the literature, is I put the addict and the family in the same room, in the same group, and we talk about what's going on. And what I find out is the family and the addict alcoholics are not anywhere near on the same page. But the goal of that is where we can understand each other, start opening up communication as to what's going on, and then we can work together as a team to find the solution. We don't want to get one better and the other stay sick. We want them to get together and to get better together. So a support circle of some sort, perhaps a prayer group or a study group on these subjects or others. Those things can all be helpful. Regular times where we are there working with each other. In the community, for the family members, we talked last night a little bit about this, there's a group called Al-Anon. Al-Anon is alcoholic, or is for those who are family members. And what you will find is people there that will get up and tell their story. You will find topics that are discussed that are of common interest to all. You will find people who are fellow travelers in this journey of craziness in families. And you'll find them there. We will also find people that can spot for us. And when we say something that is out of line, they say, you know what? You spot it, you got it. And they will call your hand on something. I remember I was at one such group as that, and there was a lady there, her name was Dawn, and all I knew is that she was the housekeeper at one of the Notre Dame facilities, and I tell you what, I haven't had my clock cleaned by anybody like she cleaned it. Because I was out here trying to, I was saying stuff that would make them think I was really smart. And she, in very clear terms, told me to knock it off and called it a few things and told me, you leave your brains out in your car and you come in here and you talk about what's going on with you or don't come back. That's about how straight you get talked to. Well, I didn't want to not come back. I didn't want folks to think I was afraid. So I went back. And when I went back, she laid into me and out came the feelings. And yes, I've had issues like this in my family that I've been on that side of the family member with. But you also need a sponsor. A sponsor is going to be somebody that will shoot square with you on things. We need those kind of people in our lives. Okay, so much more we could say on this. We could spend a long, long time on it. But as God's people, we need to take a look at what part am I playing, if any, in this person remaining sick, in this person remaining in their addiction. What part am I playing in this person's recovery? And we need to be able to define that. And guess what? You cannot do another person's recovery for them. They've got to do that for themselves. But if you also are one of the sick ones, then you need to do your recovery for you and get on the right page in terms of how to be healthy. Those are some things we wanted to say about the addicted family. And sometimes we think we're okay, and we're not. And this is about us being honest with ourselves as well. Are there questions? There are people who deny their addiction. Denial is the hallmark of an addiction. The way we help people like that, unfortunately, often is that they're not sick enough to get help yet. They haven't had enough things happen. The hardest ones to help are those who've had no consequences or relatively few consequences because they don't see it as a problem. It hasn't created any issues for me. So what we do sometimes is we have to allow that person to go out and to do their continue down the road, but be there when the opportunity comes to help them. With denial, we can try to educate them all day. Education all day is may give them information, but it's not going to make them clean. And so sometimes you have to let this thing play its course. In a family, we may need to draw some, and that's where family boundaries come in. We may need to set some boundaries down. If you're going to do this, then somebody's going to leave here. And you may have to set that boundary down. That this isn't welcome here. So either I'm leaving or you're leaving. That often will be the catalyst that will drive them into getting help. But that also takes the calculated risk that you may break up your family when you do that. That's how you do it. The other thing that comes to my mind is an intervention. Interventions, there's a TV show called Interventions, and it's not all as dramatic as that. But I've got several interventionists that I work with. And let me give you an example of how these work. There's a lady up in northern Kentucky who was a raging alcoholic. She grew up mad with her mother, and she was still mad with her mother and just defiant against her family. And she had quit the church, and her dad was just, at wit's end. What can we do? He called me. And I said, I need to get you in touch with Bruce. He's our interventionist. And they did. The plan for the intervention was to get all the people that were of significance to this person in the same room, and then, surprisingly, to bring her in when she didn't know what was going on, to get her there too. Her first statement when, I need to tell you about the preparation. The preparation for that was each one of those people wrote a letter that they wanted to read to this person. She didn't think she had a problem. And they wanted to read this letter to the person. The dad, when he started drafting his letter, Bruce had to work a lot with him because this was the dad's first letter. You have destroyed my family. I am sick and tired of you. I am ashamed of the day you were born. You get the idea. Bruce says, you can't read that. And so let's tone it down. And here's how it turned out. The day you were born and I held you in my arms for the first time, I could not have been more proud to have you as my daughter. I have loved you. I've nourished you. I've cherished you through the years. I've watched you grow into the young lady that I hoped you would be. And now our family is saddened that this has come into our life. You get the idea of that. You know what this person did? She was sitting there swinging her leg. She was mad they were doing this to her. And when her dad read that letter, the day that you were born was the best day in my life. She started crying. That's an intervention. And you know what she said? They didn't even get around the room. Each one was prepared to tell them how this gal's addiction had impacted them. They didn't get around the room. She said, what do I need to do? And they said, we have a reservation for you at a treatment center. Your bag is already packed and your ride is waiting outside. Will you go now? She said, yes. She got better. That was 2 years ago. 2 years ago. There's things we need to hear from others about how their life is impacting our life. Intervention is something you can do. Okay?
I have another one here. What can families do? What can families who have addicted members or trauma members do to avoid the home becoming out of balance, a toxic environment? I suppose they may be looking for the first step.
Okay, what's the first thing that we can do to if a family is starting to get toxic? Well, that goes back to your mission. What are your family rules? Are alcohol and drugs and that kind of behavior allowed in the house if are allowed in that family? If they're not, then what do you do if it's brought in? And that's where that tough love comes in, that you may have to say, you know, this is not okay. And while we want you in this family, you cannot do that in this family. And that's tough love. Sometimes what we can do, and I've known of folks that have done this, is we can say, you know, if you bring that stuff in this house, or you come home like that, don't worry about the police catching you. I'm going to call the police to come talk to you. And when you say that, it's like, whoa, they're serious. And a lot of times you can have an officer that would be willing to do that, or you can call and they'll send somebody by and have that talk with whoever that person is. If it's an adult, they'll probably ask, are there any guns in the house? And if so, they'll confiscate the guns. If anybody gets belligerent, they'll probably take them down to the pokey overnight. But that's something that can be done.
The last one I have is, what can I do to serve addiction?
Well, that depends on where they are in the valley. what we can do is we can be there for them. We can tell them, I'm here to help you. I'm not here to be a part of the problem. I'm here to be part of the solution. And maybe what we need to ask them is, what do you need? So that we don't have to guess what they need. We ask them to define, what is it you need? What do you need of me? If they are already in some level of treatment, we can ask for a mutual release of responsibility, of confidentiality, and with that release, we can actually have a consult with their therapist, and therapist with us, or we can go into a session where we plan, how can I help you, and what role do I play? So then you get to be a part of a treatment plan on what you can do. I really encourage that, because sometimes we have people that act independently, and we've got a therapist or someone out here, there's a treatment plan, and someone's acting independently, and we may have someone running all over the place, two or three different directions. So if you can become a part of a unified, a comprehensive treatment plan, and you can with the release of confidentiality, then that's the best way to approach it.